Welcome to Hallel Fellowship on the internet at hallel.info. This study explores the Torah reading Vayeda Kanan, covering Deuteronomy chapter 3, verse 23 through chapter 7, verse 11. It also touches on parallel passages in Isaiah 40 and Matthew 23. How is the glory of the Almighty and His words connected? What does it mean to add to or subtract from His words? If Moses couldn't enter the Promised Land, what does that mean for us? Join us as we look into these questions.
Let's start out in Deuteronomy chapter 3. So Isaiah 40 is the traditional Haftorah portion for this Torah portion. That was not selected for the reason of like the other Torah portions, Haftorah portions, which have some kind of connection to the Torah. This actual portion of the Deuteronomy 40 is not officially selected for that purpose. It's selected for totally unrelated reasons regarding how people feel good about themselves. That's what Isaiah 40 is selected for. However, just because they selected it for a different reason doesn't mean it isn't relevant. So Isaiah 40 and this Torah portion, Deuteronomy 4, so I'm tailing the 3, 4, 5, and 6, and 7, actually do have a lot of similarities. They do connect heavily. And there'll be some things you might catch along the way. So in this, I want to point out some basic fundamentals here we're discussing that we'll bring up today. The primary one being that God is a God of works. We think of things that He's done, like parting the Red Sea or all the 10 plagues or things that He's done. We imagine our God in that capacity. But God talks to us and communicates with us and identifies Himself through the words He speaks. Yes, those words result in actions, and we identify and see the actions, and we associate those actions with the words that He spoke, which is good, but He identifies Himself and explains Himself through what He says. So it's His words that actually matter to us. When we deal with topics regarding to understand our God, trying to associate things He's done with Him is not very accurate, not very good. So that is evil, just isn't very good. It's far better, far more valuable to associate our God and identify Him and His glory to the words He speaks. Those are folks' attention on today, dominantly at least. So in Deuteronomy 3, Moses, of course, starts out by reiterating or bringing up the different topics as far as how great God is, brings up His glory, how great all the wonderful things He's done, the extraordinary power, His greatness, yada, yada, which is fine. And I want to bring up a question for you, don't to answer, but think about this for a minute. So Moses, of course, recounts His pleading. Now, mind you, I'm sure some of you over your lifetimes have pleaded with God. Some tragic thing or something you really, really needed or wanted. So God, please, please. You pleaded with Him for it. And yet, in some instances, I can't say all of them, God says no. And it hurts. You may not understand why. He may not explain why. You may never find out why. But He says no. Sometimes you may say yes. I'm not saying that it's wrong. What I find interesting is that Moses, of course, pleads. He asks for God. So he's speaking to God, saying, please, I want to see this land. And of course, God says, again, no. But I want to point out, bring a question for you. So though it was not part of this Torah portion, Haftorah portion, but last week's Haftorah portion, Isaiah chapter 1, which had covered various things God was upset with, the offerings, the sacrifice, with the nature of what the people were doing and how they did them. Amongst that list was prayer in Isaiah 1, chapter 1, verse 15. That God considers prayer abhorrent in that context. So the prayer, even though it was being pleaded by a person, they were pleading with Him. It even said earnestly pleading style prayer. That is an abomination to Him. We ask, well, what does that mean? Well, we have to ask ourselves, what was the context within Isaiah's scenario that's not the same as one for Moses? Well, in Isaiah's scenario, the prayer became an abomination because the person who was praying closed their ears, and they weren't willing to listen or hear God's voice, God's instruction, God's nature, God's talking to you. If we are not willing to hear God speaking to us, then our prayers, in God's view, are an abomination. They're worthless. They're worse than worthless. So abomination is inclusive of many things, including, of course, offerings of sacrifice, but also includes abomination of sexual transactions are evil and corrupt, reported in Leviticus, I think it's 18 and 20. So abominations, God grouped those prayers, the pleading style, in abomination category. And it's, I'm not going to listen to them, which is, that's obviously fine. That God is correct in all things he does. But in this instance, God tells Moses, stop asking. I'm not going to listen to you. He doesn't call it abomination, but he does say, stop asking. And I ask myself, okay, God, why, if I'm supposed to, if God, if Moses in this case is clearly, he listens and hears God. He's not like he's closed his ears to it. But God tells Moses, stop asking. I'm not going to do this. We're done. God could always continue on and say, well, each time you ask, I'll just tell you no. But he actually insists and tells Moses, stop asking. In such that he gets angry with him. Now, the last time God was angry with Moses was with the burning bush. So it's not like he gets angry all the time. I mean, I think it's like the mean, big, bad God that bashed us over the head with a stick. He's not angry all the time. But in this instance, he got angry with Moses and stopped asking. There's a few instances in our prophets where God actually instructs the prophets, do not pray for specific things, because I will not answer them. I will say no. So there are times when God tells them to not pray for certain things. And he says, I will close my ears. He tells Jeremiah that explicitly a couple of times. So there's instances which our own prayers, which we hope and pray, don't put on words. We desire for God to hear them, hear our words go to our mouths or in our hearts, deep in our hearts. And so under certain conditions, he will not hear them. The answer is no. Not that the answer to your prayer is no, he will not hear your prayer at all. That's an interesting, kind of scary scenario, actually, in some ways, that God will, there are scenarios which I can choose my path in life to God not hear my prayers. Or in this case, Moses, God says, stop asking. The answer is no, we're done. And so it's an interesting scenario. Now, I had brought this up a long, many years ago about this process. So it is in our human nature, when we don't get our prayer answered, we ask again. That's pretty darn typical. My kids do it all the time. It's our prayers. They ask the mom. Mom says no. They go ask the dad, hoping he'll say no. Or, you know, all those things, they persist. And even Messiah said, hey, he used the parable of the man who had a guest come to his house late at night, and he had no food. He went over to his friend's house, knocked the door again and again and again, and said, please, I need bread. The guy said, hey, it's night, go away. I don't recall the address of the prayer up top of my head. But Messiah pointed out that the man who's in bed trying to get this guy to stop knocking his door eventually will go get the bread. Not because the guy in the door is his friend, because he's tired of him knocking. He's just, quit the knocking. I'm tired of hearing this. Go away. I'm going to sleep, right? The idea of annoying the individual long enough to he finally gives in. So, and God points out that, Messiah points out that with God, our prayers can be sometimes very similar. Keep asking and asking and asking, and eventually he'll get annoyed enough to finally answer the prayer. Answer might be no, but he'll answer the prayer. But in this instance, we have a scenario where God says, don't ask. I'm done listening to it. The answer is no. We're not going to ask anymore. So don't persist in asking. And I have to ask myself, that's an interesting scenario, because it is my instinct to continue to ask until I have a definitive no, or something else comes along the way. So Moses, of course, has his definitive no. And of course, he gives up, which is fine. That's good. That's fine. But the interesting to me was that God had told him specifically, stop asking. And he got angry at it for doing so. So I'd be careful about my own personal prayers. What exactly am I asking for? What is my mindset and heart set when I'm asking? Is the answer no, and I'm not willing to accept the no? Would God get irritated with me for continuing to persist? It's a curiosity. So, and to get the answer, for at least for myself, I had to go deeper in this Torah portion as well as our Haftorah portion. So in this section, we go through Deuteronomy 3, it obviously was Moses was recounting God's greatness and this in the scenario which God did not answer Moses' prayer. But in chapter 4, Moses starts relaying other information points, other details to pay attention to. And one of those are very important for us as believers or followers of God to actually take to heart, because it matters to us. In particular, I want to bring the attention of the first few verses of chapter 4. And that, we read it out loud. It says, excuse me. Now, O Israel, here to the decrees and the ordinance that I teach you to perform, that you may live, and you will come by and possess the land that Yehovah, the God of your fathers, has given to you. You shall not add to the word that I command you, nor you should subtract from it, to observe the commandments of Yehovah, your God, that I command you. Your eyes have seen what Yehovah did to Baal Peor. For every man that followed Baal Peor, Yehovah your God destroyed him from your midst. But you who cling to Yehovah your God, you are all alive today. So I stop there and say, okay, God, to answer my question, my thought process is when does a prayer cross the line? God saying, essentially, Daniel, shut up. Okay, when does that point come? And when does a point saying, no, just keep persisting asking? Well, the first thing I have to run across is this scenario, the first example that Moses gives, the adding and subtracting. Now, in this story, this passage we just read, Moses compares adding and subtracting in verse 1 and 2 to the worship of another god in verse 3 and 4. So if I add or subtract from God's words, I have now essentially compared or symbolically matched the same as worshiping another god. So I have this scenario where I have adding and subtracting from God's word, the Torah. Now, when I think of God, I know that he identified himself to us through his words. If I add something to Torah, what have I effectively done? I've added something to God's words, right? I've now changed, even though it would be small, I've changed the definition of God by adding, right? I've changed definition. So if I'm making this up, of course, right? If I say, God wanted, Joe Schmo to do X, Y, Z. I'm prove it by, some verse somewhere, whatever it is. I don't care, make up a verse. And I say, that's what he wants Joe to do. So Joe, go do that. Well, now I've actually added something that is not part of God's words, right? I have changed in Joe's definition, his mind, what God asks of him. If I tell Joe Schmo, God says, no, stop doing ABC, whatever it is, fill it in, I don't really care, because God really didn't want that anyway. Well, I've now taken something out of God's words, haven't I? If he said something, I took it away. I've changed God's definition of how he defined himself. Right, as Lorianne pointed out, that's a lot of preachers in trouble. Correct, actually it is. It's a lot of people. It's quite a scary thing to be a teacher. It's dangerous. It should be dangerous, right? It's not a pleasant thing. So if adding or subtracting, whether I add or subtract, like physically tear out pieces of God's words, or put in, add, or alternatively, if I redefine God's words, let's say I change what they mean, I alter what he intended, right? That's also dangerous ground too, for the same reasons, because it changed the perspective of the mind, the individual who's hearing me, or even my own mind, for that matter. I can change my own mind's thoughts too. So adding and subtracting is a dangerous thing. And in verse 3 and 4, it's comparable to idol worship in God's mind. We think of, I am the Lord your God, know the gods before me, that thing that the Ten Commandments, the first commandments, identifying God, who exactly what he is. Well, by adding, subtracting, or reinterpreting such a way to change its meaning and teach a course, others to do so, of course, naturally, is comparable in God's mind to idols, worshiping idols. Because I've created a God that doesn't actually exist, a modified version of what God discloses to himself. So now I have a scenario, okay, God, I have these prayers I'm sending up to you. And at some point in time, you'll either answer them yes or no, or in Moses' case, you'll say, shut up. Whatever the case would be, stop talking to me. I'm not going to listen anymore. Well, I have to watch myself as, why is that? What scenario would God say, Daniel, I'm done listening to you. Plug it up. Well, I don't know. But I do have to know, first of all, my responsibility as somebody who is claiming to follow God is, step one, don't do that. Don't add or subtract, right? So it's very difficult, mind you, those of us who are teachers, Jeff included, to be careful about what we say. Do we make mistakes? Absolutely. We can't not. We're human. But be very careful. We do make mistakes. You know, obviously, hey, oops, whatever. I made a mistake, whatever case may be. And be careful how we're teaching it. So it matters. So in my next inquiry, as far as this is concerned, since Moses compared adding or subtracting to God's word, inclusive of idol worship or worshiping an idol, that's a dangerous thing. I don't consider myself an idol worshiper. I think most of you probably don't either. That's not a natural. You may have been at some point in your life, but not necessarily now. But that's a dangerous thing to be and add or subtract. So it matters to me then if I wish to have God hear my prayers and not fall in the category of Isaiah chapter 1, which was the abomination of all your offerings, your prayers, I'm going to list them, they're all garbage. I don't fall into that category. Step one, don't add or subtract from God. Right? Don't do that. Even if I don't understand God, don't add or subtract from him. Right? I mean, understand everything, that's okay, but don't add or subtract. That's my first step. And why would I have that first step? Because fear. That's bottom line, fear. What's the fear? First, the beginning of wisdom is or fear is the beginning of wisdom. What I got the exact phrase, but that's the idea. So Jeff has a tongue play on words, just spending too much of the couch, doing too much time on the couch, snoozing the couch, make one an idol worshiper. Maybe it does. That's an interesting question. So we have these scenarios that come along. And so it makes you tired. Yeah, Lorenzo, it was a case that it makes you tired. Sleep too much. So we have these idol worshiping scenarios of adding and subtracting, and that is compared to blending worship of our God. So that we have these comparisons that Moses is making in his argument here. But it's an important thing to pay attention to. Now we have as he continues on in his passage, as we understand and explore a little bit more. He points out in verse 5. I've taught you the decrees and ordinances as Jehovah my God has commanded me to do so in the midst of the land in which you come to possess. You shall safeguard to perform them, for it is your wisdom and discernment to the eyes of the people who shall hear all these decrees and to say, quote, surely a wise and discerning people is this great nation, end quote. For which is a great nation that has a God who is so close to it as Jehovah, our God, will be called to him? And what's a great nation that has righteous decrees and ordinances, this entire Torah that I should place before you to this day? So Moses is continuing on his argument that if you wish to understand God, you have to follow his decrees and ordinances. That's pretty obvious in verse 5. So Moses points out the decrees and ordinance. And I misspelled that word. How you spell ordinance, right? But these processes, these things which Moses is teaching, those specific things are the items that he's saying, God, I'm regurgitating to you people the same thing God told me to say. So Moses isn't trying to give a variation of God. He's trying to relate to the people exactly what God told him. Now, does that mean Moses didn't make mistakes? Of course, mistakes. We all do. Hello. But it's okay to make mistakes. But the point is that was Moses' objective. That was his target goal. Was he perfect in it? Of course not. But he strived for it. Did that result in him making no mistakes? No, he did. And as a result, he still got his prayers unanswered. Actually, more specifically, he was told to be quiet. Stop talking. So these decrees and ordinances are the core foundation of avoiding the adding or subtracting process, right? That's the basic where, how do I avoid adding and subtracting? Moses said, hey, I taught you exactly what God told me in this instruction. Verbatim what he said, as best we can, we can translate to our language what God had given to Moses. That's good. So now we have a foundational standing point. This is what to not add or subtract. What Moses gave us, don't add to it, don't stretch from it. That's good. So those aren't complicated things. I can understand that. That's understandable. My mind is can figure these things out. But in verse 6, to obey these decrees and ordinances, that Moses defines as what we would today called wisdom. We call it wisdom to obey them, and understanding. That's an easy one to spell. So wisdom, understanding is to obey the decrees and ordinances. Okay, now I get my more cleared up vision of what God is trying to explain to me when it comes to hearing my prayers. So I don't get to add or subtract. Okay, I get that. Following the decrees of Moses, the ordinance that he says, follow them, don't tweak them, but obey them, is my wisdom and understanding. So if I obey his decrees and ordinances, what am I going to get? Wisdom and understanding. That's a hand-in-hand process. So if I want to understand, I got my prayers answered, what do I must do to make that happen? Obey the decrees and ordinances. Then I can get my prayers answered and understood. I can have my wisdom. So this is the basic foundation that we'll focus on a little bit, that we'll focus on a little bit today, on how this process is important to us. Okay? So that's kind of where I'm headed, where my objective or primary goal here is in this. So my job, of course, is to do this as far as following these things, get my wisdom and get my understanding and such. But I go through this, but that's fine. We were called to him because all these great decrees and ordinances is what other people will see as being valuable or identifying of God, as far as a godly person. But he points out in verse 9, beware for yourself or safeguard yourself, and greatly beware for your soul, lest you forget the things your eyes have beheld, lest you remove them from your heart all the days of your life, and make them known to your children and your children's children, on the day that you stood before Jehovah your God at Horeb, when Jehovah said to me, gather people, and I shall let them hear my words, that they shall learn to fear me all the days that they live on earth, and they shall teach their children. So it tells me, okay, to do all this, I have a primary task or methodology. My methodology to make this happen is to talk about it. I have to talk about it. I have to communicate to my kids, my children, my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, right? To discuss God's words. So if you recall, when God selected Abraham to be the recipient of all the blessings that God was going to promise Abraham, the reasoning God gave was because he said, Abraham will teach his kids. That was the condition. Nothing fancy. That was it. Abraham believed God and he would teach his kids. That was it. That's the core. So what does it tell me that I must do? Well, if I want my prayers answered, what must I do? Obviously don't add or subtract. Follow his ordinances. But the key characteristic of God's selection of Abraham, and Moses explains here, I have to teach my kids. This matters. That God matters. That I pass on God to descendants and all grandchildren, great-grandchildren, generations to come. That's my core. That's what we're getting really objective to make this happen. If I can accomplish that throughout my life, throughout your life, throughout your lives, however many lives you have, all the people you're responsible for, if you're able to accomplish that, well done. That's where we're at. So the not adding and subtracting is important. Obviously don't, because that's considered idol worship. I follow God's decrees and ordinances, and that's a wisdom understanding. I teach my kids the same thing. Pass it on. Teach others. So that's where Moses, because this is Moses' farewell address, essentially telling him, this is what you got to do. Do what I did. Because Moses did this. He didn't add and subtract. He taught God's decrees and ordinances as best he could relay it. And that was his understanding, and now he's teaching all the children of Israel the same thing. Now, Moses' own biological children, I can't see the same for. They weren't all that great. But Moses himself tried to do this to the people of Israel. And that's the example. He's saying, do this and do it well. Can't guarantee God will answer your prayer all the time, but do this and do it well. That's what matters. All right? So I won't always get my prayers answered necessarily in the way that I want to hear them answered. But I do have a foundational base the way prayers can get answered, that they don't become an abomination as we hear in Isaiah chapter 1, that they are still valuable to God and to me to hear and to listen to. So this is where I want to bring you to on this topic specifically. I want my next topic past this. Did I lose anybody on this topic at all? Hopefully not. Makes pretty good sense. Go on, move on. All right, I've been told to move on. All right. So my next topic, now that I know I don't add or subtract, because I don't worship, and I don't, and I want to teach my kids these important things of God, so I haven't lost that process. Now let's move forward a little bit, because we have something more important to discuss other than this basic idea. So in studying God, I noted that he pointed out in this idea, as far as observing God, he blends this philosophy with wisdom in the form of fear and love. So in this passage, we have this, you should love the Lord your God with your heart, because of the Shema Yisrael, the one, the tail end of in chapter 6, or near the tail end of chapter 6. We have this process of how I'm supposed to obey or love God, to hear him, and of course, and obey what he says. So as I mentioned earlier, God revealed himself by his words. That's how we know our God. Yeah, his words produced like events, like miracles, but his words are the ones that dominantly how we understand or identify who and what our God is by what he actually said, how he explained it to us, or what his parables as Messiah gave, or other stories and examples. So in this passage concept of words and what we're listening to, because it's repeated in Isaiah 40, the Haftorah portion, the idea of words is that the voice of God is actually your tool to understand our God is through his voices. His voice. He has one. His voice, as far as how he speaks to us. And in this passage, we cover through this. Studying of God will result in understanding or hearing God's voice. So we read it already once. I'll read it again. In verse 10, it's as he describes when you stood before God and what you will do, you'll teach your children. What were they doing when they gathered before God at that time? They were listening, using their ears to listen. Yeah, they could see the smoke and the clouds and the whatever fires there, but dominantly they were hearing. They complained to Moses that we're scared because we hear God and we're still alive. It's about the hearing thing that really is a big deal. So hearing God matters. And Isaiah points out the exact same thing in Isaiah 40. It's the voice of God that matters. So God reveals himself to us through words, through his voice in what he speaks, the Torah and such, but dominantly, basically, the primary thing is through words. So we understand through that. We listen to that in Isaiah 40, which the passage is often quoted. I think it's verse 3, I think it is, about the voice in the wilderness thing. The statement there is God saying words, clear path, right? Make a path in the wilderness, as well as make a straight path in the desert, or road for our God. And of course, once he says the words, Isaiah verse 5 continues on and actually makes them happen, actually makes those events take place in Isaiah 5. Then Isaiah 6, another voice said, the same voice is again, now Isaiah go proclaim something. And he says, what am I going to proclaim? And then God says that basic people, you're all worthless. You're grass, you're withered away, but I, God, am awesome. Yeah. So words are the dominant thing that God uses. All the prophets are using words. Even our, Anne was reading today in Matthew, I think it was 13, specified that it was the prophets. What's the prophet's job? But Jerusalem killed the prophets. Prophets are just speak God's words. You say the words, right? That's what prophets are doing. So God speaks to us and focuses all of our attention through words. Isaiah 40. Oops, my marker is going dry. Isaiah 40. One of the main topics he brings up in Isaiah 40 is the idea that if I hear God's voice, it's the voice is the glory of God. That's his glory. It's not his appearance. It points again. It's not like the you saw stuff. And Moses reiterates again this Torah portion. It's not about the animals or the creation above heaven, below all these things you see. That's not God. God's glory, the glory, we think of the glory of God equals his words. also known as Isaiah used the term voice. That's God's glory. Oh, final. Get that light off me. It has a funky reflection in the whiteboard I have going on up here. The light switch right there to your right. Yep, that one. Thank you. So the voice, it's God's, thank you. God's glory is the words he speaks. That's how we know him. We don't get to see God. But we know him through his words. We glorify him through the words he's said, what he's told us. That's how we know our God. And Isaiah points out that that's the voice of God is what we're actually listening to. That's our objective. Moses pointed out here that when you were at the Mount Horeb, you didn't see anything other than obviously there's this clouds and such. You didn't see an image of any object. He points out that you just heard God's voice. So our God is a God of words. That's really what he is. And that's how we identify him. Yes, he's greater than words, but those words are how we know him. So unlike humans, like myself, we are known through not primarily our words, primarily through our actions. What we do actually defines who we are. Because I can say anything to the sun. I could run off the mouth on any topic, you name it, I'll just make it up. I don't care. I'll just make up, just spew out words. They're worthless, okay? But God's not capable of doing that, but I certainly am. When it comes to actions, human beings like myself, our actions weigh us. We understand another person, good or bad. What have they done? What are they doing? What are their actions and how they handle things? Thank you, dear. So that's how we identify human beings. But God isn't that way. We identify him through the words he speaks and how he explains his words. So the glory of God really is dominantly the word choices and how he speaks to us. That's how we know our God's glory. And that's how all flesh will know God's glory. So we have when they saw this mountain and they heard the voice, their biggest complaint, and Moses cites out here, was the words that they were hearing was their scariest moment. It wasn't so much, and the mountain was scary too, but the words were the thing that they actually complained the most about. The fact that they heard God's voice and said, no one can live and hear God's voice. And that's what scared them out. So it's God's words is the primary thing that they're focused upon. And of course, but those words are the same thing that I'm supposed to focus my whole life on. So it's funny that's what makes everybody afraid. But it's also the thing I'm supposed to focus my whole identity of God on is his words. The same thing that can kill me and scare me. It's the same thing I must cling on to and hold on to dearly, which is an interesting symbol in our God as far as how he explains these things. So we have this scenario where God's words are this way, but I must hold on to those words. I have to cling to them. As he points out, those who clung to the Baal Peor died. Those who clung to God did not die. So I have to, this word, which is scary, I have to hold on to this word. So I'm going to cling on to his word. To the words, cling to the words of God. This methodology is what keeps me alive. Those who clung to the Baal Peor, the pagan at the time, which the Balaam story about the whole, you know, Midianite women, you know, sleep with all the guys, they clung to the Baal Peor. They blended God's worship with a pagan idol's worship. They clung to the wrong God. That same God that's killed them is the God I'm supposed to hold on to. It's an interesting mental picture. The item, the individual who can kill me and destroy me is an individual I must hold on to very closely to avoid him killing me and destroying me. it's an imagery as far as how I find the imagery. It's an interesting image that God has put upon us. So we study our God. We have to do this, but we do it in a form of, as I mentioned before, God blends this form of fear and love together. Because it's just to love the Lord your God with Shema Yisrael, right? Love your Lord God with all your heart, your mind, your soul, and your strength. So we have an objective that I cling to the words of God, but I have to fear him. But I also have to love him at the same time. How many of you fear and love your spouse? Probably not. Hopefully not. How many fear and love your mom or your dad? Probably not. I've got kids, yeah, but yeah, stage of life, sure, when you're a child. But generally speaking, as you're an adult, not so much. Okay. You're not really you know, fear your parents or love. It doesn't. We don't usually blend those two emotions together very often. I'm not saying it can't be blended. I'm saying it's not blended very often. But the point being that we have God telling us to both fear Him, which is how we learn our wisdom and obey Him, but also cling on to Him like we love Him at the same time. Which is interesting imagery as far as God's blending this. It's not easy for people to blend those emotions together, right? To both fear as well as love. But God points out the fear is your wisdom source. So our fear is our wisdom source. But the actual purpose, the actual methodology which we hold on to God is not through fear. Because honestly, how long does fear last? Eventually, we get tired of being afraid and we rebel. That's just human nature. We're tired of being afraid and we rebel. We all have fear. So we'll fall in front because of fear, or one of the reasons for fear. But instead, our lasting process is love. So I'm going to fear Him and love Him, which is interesting. I'm going to draw a picture, okay? This don't imagine this to be, you know, God. It's just a picture, okay? So I make this cloud-like thingamajigger, okay? And here we'll call this God in the middle. Right? So if I'm close to God, I'll put a little stick figure. If I'm close to God, I'm in pretty good standing, right? Meaning I'm obeying Him. I'm close to Him, obeying. Not physically close, but as far as obedience close to God, I'm in pretty good standing. Yeah, he may look at you too closely too, be careful. But the further away from God I choose to walk, yeah, I might get less of a microscope, but the problem is that now I have this scenario where I'm walking away from my God. So now I have this God, this little cloud-ish type image I made. Let's imagine for a minute, God has a second cloud that's a little bigger than the one He's hanging out in. Eventually, if I cross outside that other cloud's boundary, I run across the correction or the danger zone, so to speak, of God's, where the fear should be kicking in. So there's this realm, this space that I can hang around in, be near God, and I love Him, I'm fine, I'm in pretty good condition. But if I start walking too far away from Him, what's going to start happening? Well, the love is not my reason for walking away, is it? My own personal desires might be, but love doesn't make you walk away from something I love. I walk toward what I love. But my own desires may result in me walking away into personal interests, whatever. But then eventually I go far enough, I need to start thinking about the fear of God, fearing Him. So there's this space that is, I guess I would argue, an acceptable range of tolerance behavior. Okay. In this very narrow range, you can wiggle back and forth. You're okay. Go too close to God, you may have some danger. Go too far away from Him, you may have some danger. There's a space that's a happy medium. And where, for the most part, we're doing okay. We're across the scenario where Aaron's two sons got too close to God and then made a mistake. God said, oh, no, you're dead. Fear God, right? We also have a scenario where other people, so the kings of Judah, left God and walked outside the good zone, as you can call it, the good standing, and bad things happened to them. Most of them died. Yeah, ouch. Yeah, God whacks them off for various reasons. So there's this range. So when they cling God to in the form of love and I have fear blended, it's like a situational scenario. My objective is to love God and be as close to Him as I can. But if I try to walk too far away from Him, the idea is that I have the carrot sticks. We have the image of the carrot and the stick idea. You have both, here's a tree, but here's the stick in the backside. If I do something too far wrong. This wisdom idea, this fear, which is where I'm obeying God's instructions. Moses is discussing this idea. Obeying instruction, it's a wisdom aspect, which is a fear. I obey Him because of fear. Even if I don't understand them. I may understand all of God's rules or laws. I know many of them, yes, but some of them can't comprehend all of them. They're a little bit weird as far as how they're doing. I do anyway. I should do them anyway if this scenario shows up. Like the red heifer thing. Sometimes it kind of throws me because there's some oddities in there that doesn't make a lot of sense. But the fear of God says, whether I understand them or not, obey Him anyway. But the love of God makes me desire to come as close to Him as possible. So we actually have this funny blend of these two emotions, fear and love, at the same time. Fear of going too far away, or in some cases getting too close if we're disobedient, and love, the desire to actually get near him as possible, which is an interesting oddity in human nature. And I don't understand it. I'm not a psychologist, but it's just how it's interesting how we have both love and fear, and God wants them both blended when we're talking or dealing with him directly. So I find this an interesting topic or interesting conversation, idea, or imagery of God. Any questions about this so far? Because my third topic we hit independent of this topic. Hopefully we lose anybody. That's good. So again, words of God is how we understand things, how we understand who he is and what he is and how he communicates. That is his glory, is the words he communicates to us so we can comprehend him. And the next section, we're going to discuss a little bit about the Ten Commandments, actually, his words specifically, as far as what he gave. So those of you who will notice, Moses has some variations in his list here, the Ten Commandments. They're not quite identical to what's recorded in Exodus chapter 20. Oh, Deborah has a question. Go ahead, Deborah. What's your question?
Oh, my other one? Okay. Let me go back and see.
Sorry about that.
That was going back, not to this section. How do you know if God's saying no? What's the time frame? I mean, what if you've been asking for something for 40 years? I mean, where do you know when he's not saying no, when it doesn't come about immediately? What's the clue?
It's an excellent question, and it's a question that comes up to everybody. Is the answer in fact no, or is the answer not yet? Right? Because you don't necessarily know what the answer is. I don't always know what the answer is. I have my prayers. Sometimes they've been answered quickly, and sometimes not so quick. Sometimes not at all. Or at least the answer was no, and I didn't like the answer. Yeah, whatever. The idea is that we don't really know for certain. So it's really hard to tell when or what is the trigger point that the answer is no, or the answer is stop asking, right? It's not easy to figure out. So I'm not that smart. I'm just not. So in some instances, the idea of the answer being no is typically what I've seen. This is just my Daniel Agee's personal observations. So it's not that I'm right, but I've observed this a few times. Maybe you probably have observed something similar, but I don't know. Is that somebody's prayer, I don't really know what they are. They don't sit there and advertise their prayers because they don't sit there and tell anybody what their prayer happens to be. But realistically, some prayers are the answer will always be no. All right, we know there are certain prayers always be no. But we also have in our instructions of the prophets that when, or even the apostles too, when you do something on behalf of another person to assist them and help them out, and not yourself, you are not the beneficiary of any fashion, the answer typically isn't no. I found that, at least that's my observation. It's not always the case, but it's more often than not. So it's benefiting somebody else, those prayers tend to be answered more often than not. But I can't answer you, or anybody for that matter, whether God says yes or no to a given prayer. It's nearly impossible for me to know. There are scenarios which I see that people have told me years later that they prayed for this, it didn't happen, but something else happened instead. Well, that's fine too. Clearly, that seemed to be an answer. I don't have the expert explanation as to why or when a prayer is answered, or whether God says no or not yet. I don't know. So my default, which is a Jewish standard philosophy and Christian standard philosophy, is you keep asking until the answer becomes obvious. So for example, if I want to ask for you know, long life, the answer is always no. That's set. That's a given. Stop asking. Your life is set. Whatever God has set it for, it's what it is. You don't get to do something that's beyond reason. That's a given, right? So there's some things that are just default, the dumb request, don't ask for it. But I can't answer when or what the trigger point is. Clearly for Moses, he asked and God verbally told him, stop asking. We have the prophets when it comes to Jeremiah in particular, which that's what's thinking off the top of my head. God tells him, I'm going to do these various things to Jerusalem and do not pray for them because I will not listen. So Jeremiah has to follow the instructions, don't pray for Jerusalem because God said, don't pray for them. But those people who God talks to verbally directly in their voice, he doesn't talk to me like that. I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't get to God's, you know, one-on-one communication like that. So I can't answer your question, honestly, Deborah. I just don't know. It's a hard question to answer. I just pursue and try, as Moses did, try to observe and pay attention as close as I can. It's not going to be easy.
Okay, but the other part of it is, the other part I'm thinking, you know, perhaps something is causing my behavior is that, and sometimes I think something in my behavior is causing him to delay the prayer, perhaps too. You know,
that can be.
Yeah, and he doesn't speak audibly, but there was a lady that calls herself, she's a prophet. She was saying some things that, I mean, she's speaking for God, saying God said, you know, and it's a lot of stuff. And part of me feels fearful about people. A lot of that's going on lately, that God said a lot of stuff's going on in the government and that his judgment has gone out. So it's mixed with scripture, and you do hope it's true, but, you know, people are speaking for God on an uptick, I've noticed too. So
that's its own dangerous scenario too, speaking on God's behalf. So in the case of hearing somebody's voice, or is it somebody telling you something or whatever, I can't answer whether they are or are not a prophet. I wouldn't know. I don't know them. But all I can say is, if it just because somebody is able to use a few verses to prove or argue their point, I have found more often than not, they tend to neglect the verses that do not support their point. I can't say it's always the case, but more often than not. So it's, if I have, you know, let's say I make up or sorry, find a half dozen verses that prove what I'm trying to argue, and I will not bring up the five others that disprove. As a result, I'm not a very good prophet, nor am I following Moses' example of just stick with what God said, even though it's complicated, I can't understand it. Neglecting something out is dangerous. If I myself, let's pretend I'm a person, but let's say I have a particular way of life, I'm doing something, good or bad, it's a mix, we're all a mix of good and bad, and I particularly pursue a particular way of life. Let's say I have some problems in my life and I do things that aren't quite right, whatever they are. Is it reasonable for me to expect God to hear my prayer? The answer generally would be, of course not. It's not reasonable. If I am deliberately choosing something God has said, don't do when I do it, that's me, Daniel Agee, closing my ears. And God pointed out in Isaiah chapter 1, if I, Daniel Agee, close my ears, then my prayers will not be heard. God considers them an abomination. It's the same thing as if I was sleeping with half dozen ladies at the same time. I can't imagine, but the idea is absurd, a gross, grotesque abomination. So I have to be very diligent on my personal life and how I live it if I expect God to pay attention to my prayers. And is that saying that somebody who has sinned, God can't hear their prayers? I'm not saying that. We're not discussing that topic. We're saying our ears being closed, our ears not paying attention to God's words. So God may answer the questions, but if my ears are closed, he may answer my prayers. If my ears are closed, I still didn't hear it. And people do it a lot. I do it a lot. We all do it a lot. We tend to not listen. We tend to close our ears. Is what I want to hear this. So there's the classic example. It's been around for probably, I don't know, 100 years now. The whole, you know, somebody's, the waters are rising, flood's coming, and the guy in the house tries to get out of the house. Oh no, God, come save me. He hangs out of the house while the full floods, and then the boat comes. You've probably heard this thing dozens of times. Some guy in a dude in boat comes, hey, jump, says, no, I don't need a boat. God will save me. And then it continues on and the waters get higher and goes all the way up to eventually, like, the helicopter comes and says, no, I don't need you. God will save me. And the guy eventually drowns. And he says, God, why didn't you save me? Well, because I set a boat. I set a helicopter. What went wrong? I don't understand. So the idea being that sometimes we may ask a prayer and expect a particular answer because we're only seeing one thing, but we're not listening carefully enough to observe and see what God's actually doing for us. That happens too sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. So again, it's really hard because I don't know you and you don't know me as far as our personal lives are concerned, to know when I have a prayer that falls a category of God is answering, I can't hear it, or God has answered and I didn't hear it or won't listen, versus God's answering is just plain no. It's really hard to say. Larry, you have a question as well? Oh, sorry. Kate has a question, comment on this too. You have a microphone or you? They can't hear you. Come over here and speak so they can hear your question.
Okay, so I was just going to say, just because he doesn't answer your prayer doesn't mean you're necessarily doing something wrong either. So often, I actually kind of redirect my prayer as your will be done, because I don't know what's going on spiritually around us. I don't know what his life plan for me is and if my prayer falls into it or not. So I think there's different reasons it can appear that he's not answering it. I don't think there's a problem with petitioning for the desire in our heart for our life or those around us or anything like that. But I often think people sometimes are like, well, maybe I'm doing something. And I think, yeah, check that. But it doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong. But you check up there first, right? And then if he's not answering, then he has a reason. And we just aren't privy to it, which would be awesome if we were. So, okay.
Thanks for the input. Larry, you have a question? What was your question, Larry?
She was agreeing.
I know, it sounded like.
You got a question.
Hello.
Larry. Go ahead, Larry.
I've always thought that is like that we talked about, he wants us to both love and fear him, is that we should think, I think that if we don't do what he asks us to do, which is the fear, and we get fear from that, then we won't do it and we'll be able to stay closer to his love. So our fear is losing his love, is what I always thought of it.
That's an interesting way of pointing it. That's a fair assessment. The fear, although God doesn't take his love away from anybody, right? That's not his thing. He loves everything, everyone. He created all of us. But the idea or the emotional idea that if I'm afraid of losing that connection to God, that is a fair way of assessing your idea of fear too. It's a good self-check process, self-check way of making sure yourself. Yeah, the life is a good standing in your own communication with God. Anne, you have a question? Go ahead, Anne.
Well, doesn't St. Paul say, or it's in one of the epistles, perfect love casts out fear? So, yes, it does. We need reverence and fear are somehow connected in that idea of fear that, because you kind of dread him. I mean, I'm in awe of him because, wow, take a look at a fish or take a look at a insect and say, well, God knows what that insect is doing right now, even an ant and all the ants of the world. I don't mean an of the world, ants, A-N-T-S, all the ants in the world, and God knows where they are and what they're doing. After all, he cares about the sparrow that's fallen. So, I see what you mean about, just the more distant you get and then little things start happening that troubles seem to come more often. Get back to me now before it's worse. So.
Well, we get that, exactly. We get that idea when God says he chastises those who he loves, right? Not those who he hates. Or that's the idea at least. So if we see problems happening, the immediate reaction is, why? What's going on? In my own life, my own actions, how is this responding? How am I responding to God's words? Because that's how I'm supposed to know him, is through his words. So if the immediate first thing is not point at God, God, how could you? It's more of a point at yourself. What am I doing? Check my own life. What am I doing? What's in error or not in error? And that was the biggest complaint that God had, the prophets with the Israelites in Jerusalem, of course, but through all the new northern tribe as well, is that he would correct them and then they wouldn't do a self-examination. They go immediate blaming. It's your fault. You're the bad person. You're a bad God, or you're a bad whatever. And that's how they would, that was a reaction. And that's beyond childish behavior from a bunch of adults. You would not expect that type of behavior from adults. So, but that's, that was their problem, is that they refused to do a self-examination. Now, I'm not saying that Moses was you know, having problems in his personal life, nothing of the sort. We're discussing that topic. The idea is that if problems are happening and I'm not observing either the actions around me, then I'm not listening to God. I'm not hearing his voice if I'm not observing what's going on around me. Now, does that mean that my observation will answer my questions? No, it may or may not. But the first task is self-examination. That's important. So the Israelites refused self-examination. They just refused that. It was just a, I'll do my thing, God, and you do your thing, and we'll have our at-odds type of scenario. I'm not going to get much further in this because I had a lot more to cover today, but this was something that was on my heart to discuss. But one of the things I wanted to bring up, which I find interesting, you may not necessarily find it the same way, but in Moses's discussion about the created things that God made for everybody to use, the sun, the moon, the stars, whatever, the animals, things of that nature, those things are around us, and they're given to, as this passage, this Torah portion discusses, they're given to Gentiles who worship them, not you, the Israelites. We're not given to worship such things. So that class, that group of people, which is, I would say, outside our cloud of good behavior, that appears that God has allowed behaviors that we would find reprehensible or evil or wrong or anti-God, those are not considered correctable to God in our Torah portion. Meaning that other nations, other peoples, other religious groups may do things that we would say, well, God should correct them. God should not hear their prayers. God should be upset with them. And God isn't. And he isn't. We ask ourselves, well, why isn't he? He is with us if we did that, but not them for them doing that. Because those behaviors were not given to us to follow. They're given the rest of the world may follow them. That's their problem or their scenario. God specifically stated, hey, Israelites, I pulled you out of all of that. Not because you're great, not because you're wonderful, not because you're bigger, not because you're stronger. Just because I loved you. I'm pulling you out of that stuff to not act like that. But those behaviors, that's their business, not yours. And that's an important idea. When Messiah pointed out the speck in your brother's eye versus, you know, the plank in your own, is that even though the speck may be bad in your brother's eye, that's not your responsibility. You are your responsibility. So in this scenario, we have our Ten Commandments that are given. And the implication in verse 16 through 19, well, actually, my books is 16 through 19. The years is a few verses later. But the idea is that this behavior, for example, I'll make this up, okay? Some religion of, you know, Timbuktu, nowhere country. I don't care what it is. Just fill in the blank, right? So they have some religious, they have idols and they pagan practices and multiple wives and slavery and this, that, and the other thing. And they offer, you know, fruit to, you know, pieces of rock, whatever. There was all these behaviors that are reprehensible to our God, right? And God doesn't spend his time correcting them. If we do such things, because we're being given to not do that, he would, or he claims, to spend time correcting us. And he actually did. The Torah, the Tanakh is full of scenarios where he tried to correct the people for doing those exact behaviors that the neighbors were doing. The King Manasseh, right? The one of the worst kings of Judah, right? The offering of his kids. Well, the neighbors are doing it, the country next door, and God didn't get after them, right? He didn't. But he does get after you. So these scenarios are very specific to your people, the people who God has picked out as being unique or oddballs, to not act like those behaviors. And this really brings us to conclude with this parable that Messiah had given. The wheat and the tare process, right? Okay, so you, let's pretend for a minute that you're wheat. Okay, yay, I want to be wheat. Great. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I don't. Wheat says its own thing. So I'm a wheat, right? I'm out there and a bunch of the wheat around me. But then I have a bunch of tares around me too. Is our God so incapable? They cannot manage to figure out had a tear the tares out without touching the wheat? Is his hand so short that he does not have the ability to distinguish good and bad? Well, of course not. Of course he has that ability. So the parable that's given, that don't remove the tares because you might damage the wheat, that's a fine parable. I get that. But I'm talking about God here. God isn't a human being. He can quite easily select the wheat out of the tares. But yet, in our verse, my verse 20, he points out to the Israelites, you were in the crucible, the iron crucible in Egypt. And that rings bells in my head. An iron crucible, those of you who are metallurgists, I like to like metal. That's funny. Things I do for the fun. What is an iron crucible used for? To melt the metal. To remove impurities from pure. That's what it's designed for. It's what they use iron crucibles for. So they you gold, so whatever it is, you put it in there, you heat it up, get it molten, so the impurities come out. That's what I've used it for, used it for a long time. And he pointed out that's Egypt, the iron crucible. So I ask, okay, now I have a symbol, I have an image, I have an explanation that tears the wheat. How do I know I'm a wheat versus a tear? How do I know I stay a wheat versus a tear? How do I not convert a wheat to a tear or vice versa? How do I become a tear, or being a tear convert into a wheat? How do I switch from one side to the other? Well, if I'm not surrounded by those who are of the opposing side, then I don't know. But let's pretend I'm a wheat, and I can see around me a bunch of tares. Rotten individuals for various reasons. You can fill in what the blank is, and make a difference what the idea is. But basically, the poor behaviors. If I say, man, that looks really fun, guess what? Am I still a wheat? It depends. If I then convert over, say, I want to do what they're doing, I am no longer a wheat anymore. I'm now a tear. So the objective of this, of the parable, though it's more than capable of our God to separate wheat and tares, is that there is good people's behavior and bad people's behavior, and you're going to mix it together. We're all over the place. Which one do you choose? Which one do you select? Which one do you stick with? Moses. Which one do you stick with? Well, what did Moses tell us? Follow the words of God. Well, God's words, you'll maintain the wheat. But when you walk away, if you move to the tear side, you become a tear. So the world itself, the parable of the wheat, the tear, the world itself is our iron crucible. We have to decide throughout the whole life, which side do I stick with? Do I stick with being a tear or stick with being a wheat? Do I switch sides if I'm on the wrong side or I do perceive the wrong side? That's what iron crucibles are used for. Because if I look at a piece of metal, I can't tell if it's pure or not until I boil it away. Then I know. I have to find out. I have to mix it. It's mixed with other metals. I don't know what it is, what's good and bad of it until I heat it up, until I melt it. Then I know. I can figure it out. So this idea that our prayers are words of God, listening to God's voice, paying attention to it, and it's given to Israelites to follow. And God said, follow it, and you will do well. This is your wisdom. This is your love. This is your fear of God. You will be exposed and interact with people who God does not hold to the same threshold as you. And say, well, that's not fair. Fair is not the discussion matter. What did God give you to do? And what threshold does he put you to? So I look back at Moses. I start and conclude with Moses on this scenario. So in Moses, was Moses a bad man? No way. Not at all. Did he do things he probably wouldn't have done? Probably, yes. But was he a bad man? No. Look at the great things he did. Compare him to any of the other prophets that ever lived. No, hands down, Moses beat the feet small, easily. And yet God tells Moses, no, you're not going in. And stop asking. Okay, we can say, well, that's not fair. Moses, don't compare yourself to the guy Shmo next door who does get to go in. Look at all the other Israelites who did go in. Were they better than Moses? Not by a long shot. Look what happened in the boat. The very split second they crossed that sea, look what they were doing, right? They weren't better than Moses, but they got to go in and Moses didn't. And we look at that and say, that's unfair. That's not right. Moses was better than them. He deserves better. We could say that, but it doesn't mean we're right. Because Moses' requirement was higher, was more difficult, harder to accomplish, but had to get done. So Moses wasn't held the same standard of everybody else. He held a much higher standard. Guess what? You want to be a wheat, you have a higher standard. You stick with it. It's not easy. You can't guarantee your prayers will be answered. You can't compare yourself to Shmo next door, because he's not given the same requirements as you are. If he or she chooses to follow your God, that's a different story. But at this point in time, you don't know. So we have these comparisons of people. It's our natural way to compare people. It's what we do. And we learn that a grain of truth, right? We learn that comparing ourselves to others is of minimal, if not zero, value. Compare ourselves strictly to what God said and stick with that. As Moses said, obedience to God is your beginning of your wisdom. That's what it is. Obey him. Whether you understand it or not, doesn't make a difference. Obey him. Just because the guy next door doesn't, just because it looks like his or her prayers get answered and yours don't, it's none of your business. What did God give to you? Yeah. The Torah is a mirror. Look at yourself and look at ourselves. Look at what you do in life. And that's how I wanted to conclude with this idea that even though we can't necessarily always agree with God's assessment of Moses, or the fact that it seemed somewhat over the top correction against him, and such that God would not hear Moses' plea anymore, that doesn't make it right or it doesn't make it wrong. Moses was held to a standard higher than everybody else in Israel, and you and I are held to a standard higher than our neighbors. You may not think it's right, think it's fair. We're not discussing right and fair. God decides right and fair. We just have responsibilities. And if our prayers are answered or not, that's God's prerogative. Even when we think it's not fair, it doesn't matter, because it actually is. Yes, Deborah, who was your prayer? Your question, we got to Seattle. Deborah?
Oh, I am. I'm coming. Isaiah was.
Oh, go ahead.
So anyway, when I think about Moses, it's very disheartening to me because God told him to stop it, you know, just stop. And I think, you know, we can think we're close to God. You can show up at church, you could, or your worship, you're helping people. And still, I thought that standard, you know, it's disheartening. Because I think, God, if he didn't even want him, what on earth is he going to do with me? You know, it's right. Like, it's right. So, yeah, it's like when he said that to him, man, it was like a punch in the gut. That was pain to hear that.
It can be hard. We have a few comments here regarding that exact topic. So hold on a minute. Some people here want to discuss your comment here. Hold on a minute. Here. Okay, they're withholding. They don't want to get themselves in trouble. Here you go.
So we were just saying it's kind of like a parenting thing, you know, is... Oh, now I lost my train of thought. Yeah. Oh, yeah. God loved Moses, but there still had to be correction. And it's not that he didn't want him, right? And so we were discussing, you know, there's a difference between how you expect your 17-year-old to act and how you expect your 2-year-old to act. And there's consequences no matter what. You want your 17-year-old, you want your 2-year-old, but the 17, you expect more. And it's not that he didn't want him, but also there's also the fact of, like, my kids looking at somebody else's kids and going, but mom, they get to. And I'm like, I'm sorry, honey, but I'm not their mom, or they're not my kids, you know? So that's, you know, you guys don't get to do that. You can do all of this, but not that. And that's what I was thinking of, like, as far as that, just the difference. So.
With inside that example you're giving there, Kate, is that in our scenario here we're discussing, though, all humanity is the same dad. So all human beings, in the sense, so it's more of an example of an older child, which is an accurate example, as opposed to a family, another kid's family. Because it's the same father who owns us all, but he's saying, okay, I expect more from this group of people than that group. Maturity, all the reasons why, there are a lot of reasons why, and Moses is saying the same way. Right, he does have the scenarios for kill everybody. Yes, the Midianites, I think, are what was it, many nights? Amalekite, a few billion. Yeah, I said, kill them all. Don't leave anybody survivors. Right. That's correct, too. Yeah, there are differences. There are definitely differences. It's an interesting discussion. Anne, you have a comment?
Yes. Moses asked God to show him his glory, which was really quite a question, you know, quite a request. And God said he would show him his glory, but only his back parts. And, I wondered, we always kind of wondered, well, what are your back parts, Lord? Is that what you did in the past? Is that your past glory of what you did? And then the other thing is, that's one point. And the other thing is, you said, or maybe I misunderstood, you said that his glory was really his word.
Or his word's correct.
God is, yep. His glory is his word. And, yes. That's clarified also with Elijah saying, well, the Lord was not in the thunder. The Lord was not in the fire.
Right.
The Lord was not in the rivers or whatever. But then it's still small voice. And that's the one, correct, you need to discern which one. Because you got a lot of voices coming at you. And you better just get the right one. Because the other one's going to lead you down the wrong path.
Right. In this example you give with Moses and God showing it through his backside, note what happened in that story, that portion. Moses, the dominant thing that we hear or understand from that picture is actually what God said, the words he spoke leading up to that point. And then Moses reuses those words multiple times for the rest of the Torah about describing God. So even though Moses may have seen the backside of God, the actual takeaway that Moses got from that experience was the words God said. And he reused them multiple times. So we learned that in Moses' own mind, the glory of God, even though he got to see God's backside, his own mind, the takeaway from that wasn't the image we saw, but it was the words that God said at that moment in time. So we have a duplicate reiteration from Elijah that it's the words that actually God's using. That's the one he's using to identify everything about him. Larry, you have a question. I'm out of time, so make this the last one, Larry. Go ahead.
Abraham, he was asking God for things. He started out with, please don't be angry, but if it's okay with you, can you not destroy the cities for lack of so many men? And then he went further and further. Eventually, he stopped, though. I think he probably must have felt it, that he had gone far enough. But it was a little bit different than when he started out by saying, please don't be angry, I want to ask you something, rather than just saying, mm-hmm, please do this for me.
Right. Which is interesting. So it tells you that in Abraham's own word choice, he's recognizing that his request may not be in line with God's will. And he's recognizing that that scenario may be, in fact, the case. So hence, don't be angry. Moses, however, of course, God gets angry with him twice, the burning bush, of course, in this all instance here. And that clearly, if God was angry with Moses both instances, then Moses' scenario, both requests, were obviously not within God's will at those two moments in time. So being outside of God's will, obviously Abraham was very leery of doing so. His request was always saying, if basically, the Apostle James essentially said the same thing. If it is your will, I'll do X, Y, Z, whatever it is, right? Fill in the blank. So the idea is that we refer to always God's will. Even Messiah said it almost verbatim, the same principle. God, take this cup away from you, but may your will be done. So he doesn't want these things, but always your will be done. The idea that both of those men's examples were tried to point out to us that even though we may ask for something, we have to submit whatever God's will is, regardless of how it looks to us. And that's an interesting reminder of that.
I've always wondering about, the passage in the Matthew chapter 17, and it's culminate with what we are discussing about, don't stop asking, don't stop praying, don't stop. Right. Because God's time is not our time. And I think my opinion, Moses did enter the promised land. He did enter the promised land, but not in that generation, because they, at the mountain of transfiguration, they were in the promised land. Moses was there, and Elijah was there. And I was always wondering, why not Elijah? Why not Isaiah? Why not Jeremiah appearing to the master? Why is Moshe? You know, I know that, you know, in this world, we might ask God for something, and we might not receive it in this life. Because as he said, the flesh and blood will not inherit the kingdom of God. So I think eventually Moses got an answer to his prayer, because maybe that was his reward when the Messiah, Yeshua is now in the promised land. So Moshe was able to come now in glory, you know, at the mountain of the transfiguration, and he was there, and the disciples saw him. So that's how we know it was Moses, because they saw him, he was there. So, but it wasn't in the flesh as the corrupt nature, you know, that they were bringing from Egypt. Now it's a clean, it's been washed away. Now it's a new man, and that new man got to enter the promised land.
That's an interesting point. You bring that up, and since the promised land of Israel is a euphemism or a metaphor for heaven, that would make fair sense, in that the idea being that you enter to heaven, the promised land of God, of eternal life, and that symbol, that comparison, that even though you died in this life, doesn't necessarily mean you don't eventually get that promised land, and it's in a different form than what you imagined. That's a fair example. That's a good example.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's hallel.info, hallel.info.